both of our needs met.
So how did the monks interact with the California Division of Forestry and the other people fighting the fires?
Long story, but the short piece was it was, of course, a bit of a culture clash between the firefighters and the monks. But at the same time, even as I say that, there's also a lot that they have in common. You know, firefighters live in close quarters. They develop a very strong, intimate, almost familial bond with each other. And that's exactly how it is in the monastery as well. So there's an affinity, but what was very different is, of course, that the fire world operates primarily on a hierarchy, right? Orders, commands. If you don't follow an order, you're probably going to lose your job. And Zen really cultivates one's own authority and one's own experience. And so there was a bit of a disconnect between, you know, here's an order. Okay, everybody get out of the valley. Well, wait a minute. You know, if you're a Zen student, you say, well, wait a minute. Is that really what I need to do?
And so what happened? I mean, well, I remember that the Tassajara Zen monastery was in great danger in the late 70s. There was a huge fire called the Marble Cone Fire down there. Incredibly tough terrain to fight a fire in, or to deal with a fire, to meet the fire in. And then this fire was 4 or 5 years ago. What lessons had been learned in those intervening years that allowed the monastery there to kind of be prepared for yet another encounter with fire?
Well, they were really lucky, and then they had about 3 weeks to prepare. It wasn't like, oh, there's a fire coming, and it was there the next day. So they totally utilized that time in preparing, and they did have these references to, of course, there's nobody there now that was there in 1977 in the Marble Cone Fire, but there was one person who had been, who was there teaching a poetry workshop, Jane Hirschfield, and she actually helped them, you know, in terms of her own firsthand experience, and then they had logs that they had kept, and they were reading those logs. But they also knew that the fire that came in 2008 wasn't going to be the same fire as 1977, because 30 years later, you know, vegetation difference. I mean, there were going to be some similarities. One major difference was they were being told by all the agencies that you asked about, CAL FIRE and the Forest Service, we can't put people down here on the ground with you when the fire comes through. Something that's changed is the, like, institutional tolerance of risk to put firefighters in that kind of terrain. For those of you who don't know Tassajara in the audience today, it's inland from Big Sur, in incredibly rugged country in the Ventana Wilderness, and it's at the end of a 16-mile dirt road. They're all alone out there. They do have radio access and such, but, you know, it's not, you don't call 911 and the fire department's there, you know, 5 minutes later. It's an hour long journey just to get to the top of the road.
And it is also a place that native peoples used to be. There are hot springs there. There's a little creek that runs through there. I spent some time there in the early 70s and remember feeling a connection with people who were there 5,000 years prior to that, when that was probably the entire world that people knew for good years of their lives, because you couldn't easily get out or move toward the coast or something.
That's right. Well, it was a hot spring long before it was a Zen center. It was, you know, the Esalen used it, and then people from Salinas and Monterey would go, and I can't believe they would go down this road to soak in. That's a really motivated person who wants to soak in a hot springs.
I found all my relaxation disappeared on the drive out. you know, clutching the wheel, making sure I didn't roll off the cliff.
So you never should have left.
So and there have been other consequences too as a result of the fire. There was danger of mudslides the subsequent time. But and what is the word Dharma sprinklers set up on the roofs?
Yeah. As I say, they kind of knew from the beginning that they would probably be on their own, although they really didn't want to believe that, but they didn't, they just got to work and started, doing everything they could to prepare Tassajara. And one of the first things they did is build this ingenious jerry-rigged, sprinkler system.
Which is held together with a prayer and a patch, or a patch and a prayer.
Yeah. Although we don't really pray in Zen, you know, I'm being a little, taking some license there, but, one of the people who's a longtime resident there just happened to be walking by, and when they got the system up and running, it was just PVC pipe and sprinklers, you know, things you get at your garden supply store. And he said, ah, Dharma rain. And it stuck. Dharma being, you know, the teachings of the Buddha. And now they actually are hoping to build a permanent Dharma rain system.
One of the preparations was to bury a Buddha in the, was it the bocce ball court?
Yeah, the bocce ball court is a remnant of Tassajara's prior kind of wilder days before San Francisco Zen Center took it over in the mid-60s. And they didn't want to take the Buddha out. You know, this Buddha was damaged in a prior fire. They've had several experiences with fire at Tassajara, and the one that the Buddha was damaged in was actually a structure fire. The Zendo burned down, and the Buddha was kind of shattered, and actually somebody at the Asian Art Museum restored this antique Gandharan Buddha. And so it's the same one, and they didn't want to take it out. So they dug a big hole in the bocce ball court, had it waiting for when they might need it. And just as they were doing a final evacuation out of Tassajara, they put the Buddha in there and did a very brief ceremony to leave the Buddha behind to sort of, watch over things.
That sounds very mindful. I mean, the preparation was filled with mindfulness.
Yeah, it was. There was a few people that were there at that time. They were down to about 22 people on the last evacuation. And then, of course, five people are going to go back in. Those are the five people pictured just on the front of the book. And one of the people that was still around, he was a former firefighter. He's an artist. He's not a resident of the community. And he was completely struck by that they took the time in the middle of this last-minute evacuation to leave the valley because the fire was so close and the weather was very aggressive and the fire was behaving very aggressively, that they took the time to do this. You know, he was struck by that. But it is emblematic of how that community operates and conducts themselves, and that they can stay composed even in these kind of chaotic circumstances.
So there were five people who stayed behind for a while to deal with the encounter with the fire. Was there a unanimity about how to deal with the fire?
Yes. I was really struck by, I'd say the thing that made me want to write this book was when I heard, I've been a Zen student myself for many years, and I was watching the fire very closely because I love Tassajara. But when I heard that five people turned around is when I thought, a story there. And I want to know what it felt like to be standing there and make that decision. And I want to know how their practice helped them make that decision.
So what do you mean turn around? Where were they?
They were up. The road climbs. Tassajara is about 1,500 feet above sea level, and the road climbs to around 5,000 feet above sea level. And they had gone all the way up to that point of the ridge. And they reached a point where they realized, they were told by a firefighter they knew, that if they crossed that line, they would not be able to go back in. And the only reason they had all agreed to leave is because they always thought they'd be able to go back in, fuel their pumps, make sure the Dharma rain kept running. When they learned that, there were five people that said, you know, this doesn't feel right, I'm going back. And they went all the way back down the road, back into Tassajara, knowing that they would be there alone and knowing that the fire was imminent coming in. So that was a moment that was very interesting to me. And then later, a similar moment was when the fire actually did arrive. And I said to them all repeatedly, you mean you didn't, you must have looked at each other and had another little, you know, powwow. What are we going to do? Because they had agreed from the very beginning that they weren't, you know, they didn't have any fantasies about being firefighters. They really just wanted to make sure if the buildings caught fire, whatever they could manage reasonably and safely, they would do. And they wanted to keep those sprinklers running. So I said, what, you must have agreed amongst yourselves, okay, we're actually going to go and do something now. We're going to spread out around Tassajara and meet this thing. No, we didn't, actually. We all just went and got to work. So I think, to me, it was a moment of, because these people live together, they practice together day to day, they know each other so well, they know the sounds of each other's footsteps on the gravel paths around Tassajara, that they just knew. It was almost, I won't say they read each other's minds, you know, it sounds too magical, but they already had made so many great preparations and had already talked everything all through, and they were somehow able, because of that intimacy, to know that they could actually handle what they were seeing happening. Because what happened is the fire came in very fiercely. You can see a video clip of it on my website if you want, like 13 seconds of thrill. And then it slowed because of Dharma rain, because it had put all this moisture into the air. And so there's a way in which they just knew what they needed to do and went and did it, that I think came out of them being, you know, in a community that lives together and practices together day to day.
I was struck by the detail that they could recognize one another's footsteps in the gravel.
It's true. I've experienced it myself. I've spent enough time there that, you know, it's like, think about it in your own family. I'll bet you know if it's your son or your wife coming up the stairs, right?
Not always.
Well, try it. Experiment with it. You know, you get to know these very...
I know when it's the dog.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad to hear you can distinguish those.
So what happened then for these people after the time with the fire had passed?
Well, it was about 7 straight hours with the fire, and there were only 5 of them. And Tassajara is not a small place. It stretches along this creek for about a half a mile. There's a lot of structures, many of which are old, wooden. You know, we talked about San Francisco burning down. Most Japanese temples have burned down at least once in their history. And Tassajara is also very flammable, at least most of the older structures. So once they kind of realized they had, you know, the fire had passed, if you will, you know, even though it kind of lingered in the forest for much longer than that. That's when they took the picture not the one that's on the cover, but they started going around and documenting. There's another photo of them that's in the center of the book in their fire gear. And I think just breathed a big sigh of relief. And they waited for the to come, and it took relief quite a while to get there, because the road actually did shut down for a couple of weeks, and they were there again by themselves, basically, you know, keeping a vigil, a constant vigil. I mean, the fire may have passed, but you know, things burst into flame, you know, a week later, because fire had kind of traveled along the roots underground and then got into the structures, and woof, there it goes again, and they're suddenly called to action again. So it was a real lesson in you know, staying awake to each moment, because, you know, it's not like it's over now, the fire is gone now.
And in the year after, how did they cope with the recollection of that experience?
Well, you know, Tassajara, there's a couple dimensions to that. Tassajara generates a lot of income for San Francisco Zen Center, and a lot of that income was lost because it was shut down for quite a while during the summer. And so there was kind of this community coming forward. There were a lot of donations that came forward. In the end, they ended up pretty much making up the revenues that they'd lost in the summer. Emotionally, however, I think for people, there were a lot of people that wanted to come back in pretty much as soon as they could and just see it, just see what the landscape looked like. I know myself, the first time I went in was that fall, and it was breathtaking in a way that I didn't expect, actually. I expected to feel saddened by the way that the wilderness looked, but there was an incredible beauty to even the burned areas, these black twiggy branches, you know, standing up on the mountainsides, you know, it's all part of nature. It's, you know, fire is doing what it's supposed to be doing in that landscape. And for the first time to me and to my surprise, it was beautiful, actually.
There's a connection that you make with cancer in the book. And you say, even as I realized how little I could share of his experience, how much less I could control, waiting for the moment of action, it turned out, was harder than meeting it when it arrived. So I understood how it must have felt for the monks waiting for the fire. I knew myself the power of actually meeting something, not being before it or behind it, but simply in it. When cancer spreads, when the fire finally arrives, there is no question where your life is at that moment. You become a fire monk.
Yeah, I'm talking about my husband's cancer in that, and I found that when I got to the end of the book, I wrote an afterword, and my editor read it, and she said, "Well, okay, you know, it's okay, but start over." And I did, and what I did in that afterword is really took this story into my own life, because really what I'm sharing is not just something that happened. It's a history. It's a chronology of an important event. But it's also really about the sort of metaphorical aspect of wildfire, and how really, I mean, what the Buddha taught is that the world is on fire. Everything's constantly changing. You and I are on fire right now, Sej, believe it or not. And all we can do is basically meet that, you know, accept that and meet that as best we can. And so the whole story becomes kind of an allegory for that approach to life. And I found that at the end, I wanted to share with a reader how I took it into my own, how this story mattered to my own life.
So you learned from these fire monks how to become a fire monk yourself.
That's right. And we're fire monks. I mean, you know, they didn't have some sort of extraordinary ability. What they did is not something any one of us could not actually do. They just are very adept at and well practiced at paying attention. That's what they do in their Zen practice, and that's what really was the most powerful tool they had in their toolkit here in meeting this fire.
The book is called Fire Monks, Zen Mind Meets Wildfire, Colleen Morton Bush. And visit our website, and you can find it through our website at wcl.org. Thank you very much for being on West Coast Live.
Thank you, Sedge.
And that's today's West Coast Live, our fire theme, produced by Case Conover, engineered by Mitchell Holman here today with David Nerio, Larry Gay and Cassie Gay behind the scenes, Aurel Lanter, Michael Gleason, Kathy Selleck, and Sally Barrows, Romilly Thompson, cable coordinator, Mike Greenso at the piano. Thanks to everyone here at Yoshi's, Ash Maynard, Jeremy Trent. We'll be back next week here. Safe journey. We're at WCL.org.